Good morning, everybody. This is Peter Angood at the National Quality Forum. Tejal Gandhi is our chair for this technical advisory panel, but I will spend a few moments just providing some introductory comments, and then we'll turn this all over to Tejal shortly thereafter. I am the senior advisor for patient safety at the National Quality Forum and oversee a variety of projects as it relates to patient safety. An important one is this whole focus on the serious reportable events, and this technical advisory panel is a component of our overall program. Before we get fully started today, we need to do two things. One is just go around the virtual table here and get introductions by everyone. And while doing that, we'll also get any disclosures or potential conflicts of interest done verbally as well. We're in a new era at NQF by doing these types of conferences by conference call and not face-to-face meetings, and we appreciate your taking the time to do that with us. We all know there's benefits of face-to-face meetings, but we've also found that the complexity of trying to schedule face-to-face meetings is getting more and more complicated these days. And with the number of projects we have going, it gets to be a budget issue for us as well. So we're doing these by conference call. And so far, that has been working out very well. But we do recognize it's a big chunk of time to be sitting at your desk or wherever you are taking your call. And so we appreciate your tolerance for that. We'll make sure that there's appropriate breaks put into place. And if you need to take a short break, please just let us know, and that way we won't be expecting you to respond to any comments. So the sequence for the moment will be Lindsay, Ty will do a roll call. When your name is mentioned, please give just a short introduction of who you are and where you're from, and then give any potential conflict of interest.
Peter, this is Ann. I need to...
I haven't forgotten you, Ann, and just about to say Ann Hammersmith is going to give you a short formal description of this conflict or disclosures of interest piece so that we do this all by our due process. So when the roll call happens, give a short introduction and then follow the guidelines that Ann is just about to describe. So Ann, please.
Okay, thank you, Peter. I'm Ann Hammersmith. I'm NQF's General Counsel. You'll recall that before you were named to the committee, we sent you a disclosure of interest form, which you all completed and returned, and we reviewed those forms. We would like to do an oral disclosure so that each committee member will know where fellow committee members are coming from. As Peter said, Lindsay will call the roll. If you could tell us who you're with, and then just disclose anything that you believe needs to be disclosed regarding your background. We certainly don't expect you to summarize your CV, nor do we want you to. And we do this in the spirit of transparency and openness, which is, as you know, that's what NQF is all about. I also want to remind you that you represent yourselves on this committee as individuals, not as a representative of the organization that you work for, and not as a representative of whomever may have nominated you. So, Lindsay, if you could go ahead and call the roll, please.
Tejal Gandhi.
Hi, this is Tejal Gandhi. I am an internist and director of patient safety at Partners Healthcare in Boston, and also serve on the NQF SRE steering committee, and I do not have any disclosures.
Thank you.
Stephen Kaplan.
Steve, if you're trying to talk, you might be on mute.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, sorry about that. So I'm Stephen Kaplan. I'm the Chief Medical Director and Quality and Patient Safety Officer for Ambulatory Care at New York Presbyterian Hospital. And I'm trained as an internist, but spent 18 years of my career practicing emergency medicine and assumed my current role just nearly 2 years ago. And I have no disclosures.
Thank you.
Catherine Roberts.
Hi, it's Catherine Roberts. I'm at the Mayo Clinic in Arizona. I'm a radiologist. I'm also the patient safety officer for my institution. I did list quite a few organizations that I'm affiliated with based on the definition on the conflict of interest form. I do not personally feel these are conflicts of interest, but it did ask if you're a board member, and I am a board member for radiological societies and committee member for multiple predominantly radiological societies. These are all in the realms of quality, patient safety, and education.
Thank you.
Michael Steinman.
Hi, I'm a geriatrician and a clinician investigator at UCSF, San Francisco VA, and I have no disclosures.
Thank you.
And have we been joined by Diana Swanson? Okay, James Taylor.
Hi, Jim Taylor. I'm a dermatologist at the Cleveland Clinic in Cleveland, Ohio. I'm also deputy chair of the Patient Safety Committee for the American Academy of Dermatology. I over-disclose and have multiple disclosures of multiple organizations of which I'm a member, been an officer, recent officer. I own some stock in pharmaceutical companies that I've had for years. I listed 16 organizations. I'm not sure any of these have direct conflict. Everything has indirect relationships with everything we do, but I don't think anything's directly related to this specific.
Okay, thank you.
Saul Weingart?
Yeah, I'm a primary care internist, and I also see survivors at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, where I'm the VP for quality. I don't have any conflicts.
Thank you.
And have we been joined by Elizabeth Wirtz-Evans? Okay.
Okay, thank you everyone for those disclosures. Do you have any questions of each other regarding these disclosures, or do you have any questions of me? Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ann. All right, everyone. Thank you again for that. And just listening to your introductions just reaffirms for me what a strong panel that we do have here for this particular project. I'm going to give just a couple of background comments again. This is not an introductory conference call like we did previously. And then after that, I'll turn this all over to Tejal for her to take us through the whole process of the morning. As you know, the NQF serious reportable events are well taken up in healthcare these days. They form the basis of most all of the state-based reporting activity that's out there. They are incorporated into the federal patient safety organization reporting activities. Some of the payers utilize them, as well as a variety of healthcare systems. The SREs have been in place for almost a decade now, and as part of our contract work with the Department of Health and Human Services, it was decided to be an important part of that work in reviewing the existing serious reportable events, possibly adding to that list, and then also expanding the concept of the serious reportable events into some new non-hospital environments. And the three environments chosen were the long-term care or skilled nursing facilities, the ambulatory surgery environment, and this physician-based office practice environment as well.
Pardon the interruption. Ms. Diana Swanson is joined.
I apologize for being late.
No problem, Diana. It's Peter Angood, We were just getting started. I was just giving a bit of brief background. We have most all of the individuals named on the tap who are present, and we just finished doing some brief introductions of ourselves as well as a verbal description of whether we had any disclosures or conflicts of interest. So for the group, perhaps why don't you go ahead and just tell them who you are, Diana?
Okay. You can call me Dee. I am a family nurse practitioner in a rural practice in southern Indiana. I have no disclosures other than I am the past president of the American Academy of Nurse Practitioners. I am also on the Nursing Alliance for Quality Care, the JACO PTAC for hospitals, governmental affairs liaison for a nurse practitioner group in Indiana, and I have no industry affiliations.
Great. Thanks very much.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate that. So the uptake of the serious reportable events is broad-based, and we're under this process of review and expansion into other environments. We do not influence how the SREs are taken up. That's up to the marketplace, if you will. But NQF does run this rigorous consensus development process, which you've all been oriented towards before. The serious reportable events, however, are a little bit different than other measures or standards that are submitted to NQF. The other measures and standards that are submitted to NQF in response to our various calls, those are developed by outside non-NQF entities. The SREs are different in that this is a program that originated with NQF and continues to be maintained by NQF. And so we will be following the consensus development process in order to have full input, full transparency, and opportunity for public comment all of the way through. But unlike the other types of measures and standards, we as an organization oversee the development and maintenance of these. To that end, the call for SREs did get a good response, and those are all submitted from external sources, and we'll be discussing those as we go through this. If during the discussions we come up with some ideas that you think are important to add as potential new SREs or relevant SREs to this environment, then we're certainly open to having those added, but with the caveat that we still need to have all of the information put into place on a formal submission form so that we can take that new idea through the same sorts of consensus development processes, the transparency, opportunity for public comment. Excuse me. This is important. We want you to be open to suggesting relevant topic areas, but we also need to be mindful of the processes we have in place so we don't have, you know, someone's special project popping through the system and landing there without an appropriate due process. So with that as background comments, it's an important program. The timeliness of the program's revision is very good, especially with healthcare reform going on and all of the changes. And so the work that you guys are doing with this particular environment, I think, is going to be one that creates a lot of interest and a lot of scrutiny, depending on how our final results come out. Because, as you all know, this is a tough environment to really get close to and how to monitor it effectively. So with that, I'm happy to answer any further questions, offer any clarifications, and we'll turn it over to Tejal in just a moment. Questions or comments?
Peter, this is Tejal. It might be helpful, based on some emails I got, to just clarify again the scope of this particular TAP in terms of the setting. I know it's ambulatory practice settings, specifically physician offices, but do you want to clarify that what that may or may not include in terms of you know, hospital ambulatory departments or things like that?
Right. And it's an important question. The steering committee that we have for overviewing all of the serious reportable events debated this quite a bit. And the purpose of the expansion into other environments is to get away from the hospital or the traditional hospital setting. And so while we recognize there are a lot of clinics in different hospital settings, especially the teaching hospitals, the primary focus is towards the physician-based office practice setting, and recognizing as well that those settings often have a variety of nurse practitioners, PAs, physician extenders, whatever you would like to call them. And so that is an important component of this as well. This is not about emergency departments, and it's not necessarily about mini clinics or those types of environments as well. Melinda Murphy, did you want to add any further comments on our process or perspectives of the project?
No, thank you.
Okay.
This is Mike Simon. I just had actually one question about sort of the way that these have been historically uptaken and anticipated future uptake, in which the SREs have been evaluated purely as a quality improvement sort of monitoring function, and to what extent they have been used or perceived as a punitive
right.
measure.
Right. Well, as I said, we don't directly influence, nor do we try to directly influence the uptake of the SREs once they are endorsed and approved by this committee. Historically, the two previous versions of the SRE development has been not quite as rigorous as this, but it has been an open and transparent process, and there's been public comment. In the states, there are now 28 state-based reporting agencies out there that are mandated, and several of them, I think the last number I saw was 16 or 17, pretty much use the SREs directly, as listed from NQF. The remainder use modifications of the list, adding to or subtracting from. And so that's been a heavy area of uptake. As mentioned, the evolving patient safety organization initiative from the federal government, and they have what are called the common formats that have recently been developed, and the SREs are built into that as well. As you know, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid have their so-called never events, non-payment for 10 different items. And several of those are originating from the NQF SREs, but many of them, not many of them, but some of them are not NQF SREs. And there's no direct tie-in as to whether or not CMS will continue to use the NQF SRE list for future payment strategies. Those are the main areas. The difficulty NQF has is we don't have, as a result of that type of uptake, a good monitoring strategy at this point yet as to the efficacy of the uptake of those. We have some initiatives moving along in that direction, but we're not there just yet in terms of how do we evaluate the outcome or the outputs from uptake of SREs. I know that the popularity of it in this country and that uptake I just described has got the attention of a few different ministries of health in different countries, and a few other countries have already taken this approach or are considering taking a similar approach such as this. Does that help?
Sure.
Okay. All righty. Well, we need to get to work. So, Tejal, I'll turn this over to you. And Lindsay will be keeping us up to speed on the webcast portions of this. And Tejal, we're here to provide support as needed.
Great. Thank you, Peter. So thanks, everyone, for joining this call. And hopefully we can be really quick and efficient And I know the agenda doesn't have any breaks listed, but we'll definitely try to do a break maybe around noontime or so for a little bit so folks can grab their lunch or do whatever they need to do for a few minutes. So from my understanding, what we need to do is actually review the existing SREs as well as the new newly proposed SREs and discuss their relevance to our particular TAP setting, the office practice setting. And there's some questions that that Lindsay had emailed out in advance, which was going to be the approach for reviewing both the existing and the new SREs, as well as the current definition for SREs or the newly updated definition for SREs. So hopefully folks have had a chance to review that document prior to this call. I think, Lindsay, you sent that out a couple of days ago. So on the screen is projecting from Lindsay's computer the list of, first we'll walk through existing SREs, and so it will list the SRE itself, and then also scrolling to the right, there's a summary of suggested modifications and other things we'll get to. But the first question that we need to ask ourselves, and we can start with the first one, is this SRE relevant to the care environment for which our TAP has responsibility? And just actually before we start with that, I wanted to just walk through the SRE definition just because it has changed a bit from what was previously out there. And again, I'm sure most of you have read this, but I'll just read through it. So SREs are defined as preventable, serious, and unambiguous adverse events. And in the document Lindsay sent out, the definitions of unambiguous, preventable, and serious are listed. The major change to the definition is under the preventability category, because the definition now states some types of SREs are universally preventable and should never occur. Other types of SREs are largely preventable and over time may be reduced to zero as knowledge and safe practices evolve. So both of those types of events are included in the SRE definition, and this kind of came about especially with things like falls and decubitus ulcers, which are largely preventable but not universally preventable. So that's the definition that the steering group has come up with, and that's been publicly vetted, et cetera, and so that's what we'll use for our purposes today. Any questions before we get started? Okay, great. So the first one on the spreadsheet that's on our screens is surgery performed on the wrong body part. So is this SRE relevant to our care environment? Comments?
Just all, I certainly think so. A lot of office-based procedures.
Yes, this is Stephen Kaplan. I would agree. You know, if you look at practices where there's, you know, OBGYN does procedures, dermatologists do procedures, you know, lots of office-based processes that would be considered quote-unquote surgery that I think should be considered here.
Absolutely, and as we get to the modifications too, we might think about changing the word surgery to be a little more broad, but I agree as well that this definitely is relevant to the office practice setting. Anyone who doesn't think it is? Okay.
I don't disagree. I just think, as you said, it would be important just to clarify what exactly is meant by surgery.
Yeah, absolutely, and we'll get to that. Question two, is the SRE discrete, auditable, and clearly defined?
So that's exactly what we were just saying. It might ought to be defined a little better.
Agree. So we'll come up with a solution to that, again, as we go forward, because I know in the suggested modifications there's some suggested language that we'll get to. So besides the kind of defining what surgery actually is, the rest of it in terms of the actual event of being something being performed on the wrong body part, does that seem pretty clearly defined?
Yes. It's Peter. I'll just make a comment about something I forgot to earlier, and that is sort of the difference between the TAP's function and role and the steering committee's. The TAP's role is primarily to offer advice on the appropriateness and all the other criteria for the SREs one by one. And if there are specific issues that need to be better teased out, then certainly the TAP is encouraged to do that. But the final determinations on the sticky issues or the debatable points on some of these topics actually will lie within the steering committee, as the steering committee reviews all of the different aspects of that topic area that which may be debatable. So as an example, the definition of what actually is surgery or procedure will lie more towards the steering committee, but certainly the input from the TAP is important, but we don't want you to be heading down a long extended debate about what is a procedure or what is a surgery at this point in time, just as an example. I just wanted to make sure we clarified that further for you. Thanks.
So should we identify those areas that we think should get greater attention or greater clarification by the steering committee?
Yeah, by all means. And to continue on this same particular topic, for example, there is in the hospital environment a whole debate about when is the end of surgery. And that has major ramifications for a lot of reasons. And so the steering committee will be making that level of determination. As you guys go through the different SREs, if there is a topic that certainly needs to be highlighted, and if you have a quick and easy suggestion, by all means, we'll take that, we'll write it down. But if it's going to be a bit longer discussion or debate, then we take it as, okay, this is an important area that the TAP feels is important to get better clarification on.
Thanks, Peter. That's helpful.
This is Mike. I'll just offer one thing that maybe just food for thought, just looking at the exact definitions of serious in particular. It's defined as describing an event that can result in death or loss of body part, disability, or loss of bodily function. There may be exceptions, but it strikes me that for the most part in ambulatory office-based settings, that even a wrong site surgery would not likely meet the serious criteria. Hard to imagine many procedures that would result in that, even if done in the wrong place, in an office-based setting.
Well, I was thinking about more orthopedic procedures, injections or TAPs. You could get an infection, or oncology procedures, tapping central reservoirs, things like that. So I think I agree with you about primary care, but I wonder about some of the specialty practices.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, and we got into a little bit of this similar discussion with our other TAP yesterday in long-term care. And while we certainly need to be focused on the patients and the impact on the patients, some of the discussion comes out, well, it may not be high impact on the patient, but it certainly is demonstrative of a system failure that a wrong patient was operated on, for example. So you need to pay attention to both aspects, the systems and processes, as well as the patient.
But I think we need to, or at least recommend, a clarification on serious in this setting, because as was just mentioned, use orthopedics or rheumatology procedure. If you want to inject a shoulder with steroids, let's say, and you inject the wrong shoulder, impact that causes loss of body function or harm or death, but that's a serious error.
Correct.
So I think that would be a comment that we should pass forward to the steering committee is in the ambulatory settings, particularly the definition of serious might need to be expanded a little bit. Because I agree, there's a lot of, there's a lot of procedures that can be done on the wrong side that may not end up in the serious of an outcome, yet are clearly, should never happen.
Right. It may, and just in terms of definitionally, the injection example is a good one, but it may not fall into the category of surgery per se. So it may be useful to sort of reconceptualize or reword it as maybe procedures as opposed to surgery per se.
Right. Yeah. Or you could use sort of I think a lot of it's going to fall into specialties. Use the ENT example and putting meningotomy tubes in a kid and you do one side or the wrong side or whatever it may be. Clearly a procedure. May be considered surgery and serious if you do the wrong side.
So let's move forward because I think we'll get to the issue of what we want to call is instead of surgery, and we won't get too bogged down with it, hopefully, because as Peter said, the steering group will be the final arbiter of that. But so does this SRE meet the definitional criteria of serious, unambiguous, and preventable? or largely preventable. And we've already talked about the serious piece and how we might want to expand that. But other than that, do folks think that this SRE, this does meet the definitional criteria?
Yes.
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 Okay. So then if we scroll to the column that says summary of suggested modifications, there's some examples of wording changes that were recommended, invasive procedure, changing body part to site, et cetera. So, you know, there are some good recommendations here. Peter, how much do you want us to go into those recommendations, or just should we say we recommend considering some of these changes?
Yeah, that's a good point and question. The steering committee itself has not gone through these modifications or suggestions either, and the staff recommendations are just that, things that we or ideas that we think are relevant for each of the suggested modifications for the steering committee to review. So if there, I think it's important for the TAP to look through them, and if there's something that is important to flag out, then by all means we'll take that. But the steering committee hasn't even debated these yet, and we'll give each of the TAPs opportunity after the steering committee reviews these to get the feedback on how the outcome from the steering committee came together.
Okay, so why don't we walk through them quickly and just get a sense from folks of what they think of these. So invasive procedure as opposed to surgery. My thought on this one was maybe it should just be procedure as opposed to invasive procedure, because I think people get a little bogged down with the word invasive, but I'd like to hear thoughts on that.
I like either invasive or invasive procedure or procedure. I think they're both fine.
I would agree. I think eliminating invasive will open it up to other procedures that might be more appropriate in an ambulatory setting.
Agreed. Especially for ambulatory. Number two, changing body part to site. Anyone feel strongly one way or another?
I'm agnostic.
I probably like site better, but don't feel strongly.
I prefer site because if you were removing something from, say, a chest or a back, but they removed the wrong skin lesion, that could still be called the same body part, but it's the wrong site. So preference for site.
Okay. Recommend changing the overall category to surgical and other invasive procedures rather than surgery. So that's a good idea. These, you know, these SREs are lumped into overall categories such as environmental and so on, and I think this one is called surgical, so I think changing the name of the overall category would be a good idea.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Consider surgical and other procedures, same as number one, not including invasive.
Correct. Agree. So that's for number three. Number four, suggestion to combine surgery performed on the wrong body part with surgery performed on the wrong patient into one SRE.
I disagree with that one.
I disagree as well. I think they're separate, equally important, discrete errors.
I agree also.
Yeah, agree that they should be separate. Number five, separate surgical versus invasive procedures. So do we want to separate out surgical versus invasive? I think it's okay to combine as long as we expand the definition. Do folks agree with that?
Sure. I agree.
Okay. And then the last one, add the phrase based on informed consent and or documented plan variation. So this is, you know, determining if it was the incorrect site, and they're saying based on what's on the informed consent or in the plan. That's, you know, I think a clarification that I could take or leave.
What were those crazy partners people thinking?
I know. What can I say? But as I said, I could take or leave it. But
you say what the idea of that was? It seems to me that's a little sort of protecting the provider or the practitioner to say, well, I said on the consent you could do this, we might do this as well. It seems a little...
I actually don't recall where this one came from, but I think it was based on how do you decide. So if you went into the surgery and you did say we're going to do X, but we may have to do Y, and then you know then you end up doing Y, that should not necessarily be a wrong site because you thought you might have to do it. So I think they were trying to cover those scenarios, but I think it's probably a bit of overkill.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah, and also a lot of procedures aren't consented in ambulatory care, so.
Exactly, so that's probably even less relevant for this tab. Okay, and then is some of our recommendations about modification to the existing. Are there any other modifications that folks would recommend beyond what we've talked about? One thing I thought about was just in the implementation guidance to have a few more examples that are more ambulatory relevant because it's very kind of inpatient focused.
I mean, I think that's probably going to be important as we move forward overall. If the SREs are expanding to these three new environments, that clearly these three new environments are considered as there's information provided about the SREs.
Agree. So maybe we can just make that a global comment back as, you know, the implementation guidance in particular and the examples and all of that should really be specific to the environment that these are focused on.
At least inclusive of those environments.
Right. Depending on how they're going to do it, I'm not sure if they're going to have separate lists or depending on how they end up doing it. But, yes, it needs to at least be inclusive. Okay. And then the last question for this one, is the event entirely preventable or largely preventable? I think the wrong side, wrong body part or wrong site in the past was really considered as an entirely preventable category by the steering committee, but if folks think differently, we can discuss.
Well, I guess this is Mike. The reason why it might not be universally preventable is if the patient self-identifies the wrong lesion. I said to take off this mole, and in fact, it ended up being the other mole. So it's kind of more of a patient error compounding the physician error. I don't know practically how much that would play out, but that's just one possible way in which it may not be universally preventable.
That's true, though with a safety pause and other things, if there's a discrepancy between what the physician thinks and the patient thinks, they should at least be meeting and resolving it and maybe reviewing previous notes or other things. So there should be process to sort of escalate if there's kind of a discrepancy between what the patient's saying and the physician's understanding was.
And even then, would it be considered a wrong site procedure if, you know, the one the patient pointed out, and that's the one you took off, and that's the one you intended to take off, it might not have been the one that ultimately should have been taken off, but it was.
But that was the plan.
That was the plan. So, you know, it's one of those tough things because you want to sort of never say never, but it does sound like you should never operate on the wrong body part or wrong lesion or wrong patient.
Yeah.
I would say we should advocate for entirely preventable on these.
I agree.
Agree, entirely preventable.
Okay. So, Lindsay, is there anything else that I've missed that we need to be going through for each of these as we go forward?
No, that was great. Thank you.
Okay. So let's move on to the next one. So the next one is surgery performed on the wrong patient. Hold on a second. I'm trying to scroll down on my screen. Lindsay, can you? Okay, here we go. So for this one, is this SRE relevant to our care environment?
Absolutely.
I would say yes.
Yep.
Is the SRE discrete, auditable, and clearly defined? Again, I would say yes.
Yep.
Does the SRE meet the definitional criteria of serious, unambiguous, and preventable or largely preventable?
Yes.
Agree. Anyone disagree with that? Okay. And so if yes, again, going to that modification column, we can walk through what some of the suggested modifications are. So let's see here. So they say recommending modifying to wrong invasive procedure again. So wrong procedure is, instead of wrong surgical procedure, they again recommend changing it to invasive procedure, or in our, what we've already decided, we would just say wrong procedure for this one. Does everyone agree?
I agree. I think a lot of the things we set up about, you know, previously will apply for this with the same kind of syntax.
Yep, agree. So we probably, and so number two is the same as what we've already discussed. And number three, we've already discussed that we don't want to separate it out. So I think that's fine. And then any other modifications that anyone would suggest?
Jim, you know, the issue of patient misidentification really isn't it's assumed, but it's really not discussed under preventability or implementation guidelines. It only deals with surgery, so somewhere the Joint Commission, you know, two pieces of recommendation for patient identification should be there, I think, somewhere.
Sorry, you know what? We lost my place on the scrolling. So as I was trying to figure that out, I missed what your comment was. So could you repeat that, please?
Well, there's a surgery performed on the wrong patient. It assumes patient misidentification, but that's not discussed. They only discuss, if I'm reading this correctly, surgical procedures. They don't discuss patient identifiers as defined by the Joint Commission and so forth. So somewhere that ought to, I would think, should be in there.
In the
discussion of it somewhere, either in the implementation or preventability.
Yep, I think that's a good point that should be added in.
Yep. I would agree with that. I think that's important, and I think it's one of the things that's clearly different from the hospital environment where patients mostly have, you know, identifying wristbands on or something. And in the ambulatory setting, they don't, and necessarily or often, usually in a doctor's office, I would think not. And so you use two identifiers, but they're different than you would use in a hospital setting.
Yeah, so definitely at least describing what best practice would be and just the fact that the patient identification piece is so critical, and maybe even more critical in ambulatory, I think would be a good addition.
Yeah, just to back up, Jim, again, I'm trying to find it. I can't shuffle the papers, but it was the I thought surgery is defined as an invasive procedure in the 2006 update for the SREs.
I think it is. I guess what we want to do is even just rename it in the name of the SRE as opposed to just in the definition.
Yeah.
And also change it to procedure as opposed to invasive procedure.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, these are under surgical events, and then it's called surgery, and people just automatically block it out if they're not surgeons, basically. So
right.
Trying to prevent that from happening.
And in my experience, it's repeating to some extent, but I think there are more invasive procedures performed in office settings than you realize. That's certainly true in our specialty, dermatology, and there are others. So anyway.
I agree. I think we should not lose sight of that.
Yep. Well, right, and there is another tap on office-based surgery as well, from my understanding, but I agree, even in the clinic setting, they are happening.
Well, I think that's an important point, that ambulatory surgery centers is kind of where you think ambulatory surgery occurs, and people don't necessarily think of primary care doctor's offices or specialty outpatient doctor's offices as surgery sites, and I think they are, or procedural sites, certainly.
Procedural sites.
Okay. Right, they're not all, most offices are not certified by AAAHC or the plastic surgeons or the other group.
Any other modifications to this one, to the surgery performed on the wrong patient one? And would folks say this event is entirely preventable or largely preventable?
Entirely.
Agreed.
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 Okay, so scrolling down to letter C. Hold on a second. So this one is wrong surgical procedure performed on a patient, which will probably have a lot of the same themes echoing through. So relevant to our CAP setting?
Yep.
Yes. Discrete, auditable, and clearly defined?
Yep.
Does it meet our criteria? Serious, unambiguous, and preventable?
Hopefully.
it does go back. Again, we had a little discussion about what if, you know, you remove in derm, let's say, the wrong lesion. Is that considered wrong procedure? There may be quirks to this that yep. could use some clarification, but I think overall it's following the same path as what we've talked about previously.
Okay.
Right. And then just definitionally under the definition, it would obviously need to be updated to reflect the ambulatory setting, but also there's the informed consent issue that was raised earlier that's defined in the definition that would need to be modified.
Because there's often not informed consent in some of these ambulatory settings?
Right.
Quite frequently in primary care.
Right.
And presumably there should be some form of informed consent with the discussion between the provider and the patient, but it's not as formalized and documented or with a document per se as in the probably inpatient or surgical, true, if you will, surgical.
Correct. Yeah, there's probably not a signed form.
And I don't think we should go down the path of saying there's not informed consent. I think that's a bad slippery slope. I think there is informed consent. The process of doing it and documenting it is probably different in an ambulatory setting. Would people agree or no?
Actually, I this is Dee. I dissent on that because I am aware of situations in ambulatory practices where specialty practices, things, injections, for instance, are given quickly and before consent occurs. That just happened recently with one of my patients.
But you don't think that there's a discussion with the patient of why they're doing it and what are the risks and benefits and that there is consent based on the patient says, okay, go ahead?
That's exactly what I'm saying. That did not occur.
Really?
But it's more the exception. I mean, I think
it is an exception. However, you know, are we not looking at everything?
But is that an acceptable exception then?
It is not an acceptable
right.
exception.
So we may still want to make that an important part of this and say that would be a departure from standard. So there is or should be an informed consent process, but it's, you know, maybe a little more relaxed in how it's carried out, but not excluded in this environment.
That seems reasonable.
So that would be a good clarification in the implementation section, at least, to sort of clarify that the expectation is that informed consent is occurring, even if it's not as formalized as in an inpatient surgical setting.
Right.
Yes,
absolutely.
Okay. Any other modifications? I think the modifications in the column are all ones we've talked about.
You know, just from the informed consent issue, this has been a huge issue at our place. But, for instance, I think only physicians can obtain informed consent from legally, so nurses cannot. And but anyway.
I mean, are you saying if a nurse is doing a procedure, the nurse still can't? Doesn't obtain informed consent for the provider who's doing the procedure?
The nurse doesn't do informed consent for the physician.
And we can defer to Dee, but if a nurse practitioner is doing a procedure, I believe a nurse practitioner
Yeah, I think that the issue is the person who is doing the procedure obtains the informed consent.
Yes.
Okay, so I think the recommendation will be that we should have some language around informed consent in the ambulatory setting in particular to make that piece very clear.
I think that's good.
Okay. And any other modifications to this one? And is this event entirely preventable or largely preventable?
Entirely.
Agree. Anyone disagree with that? Okay. Okay. Let's move on to letter D, which is unintended retention of a foreign body. of a foreign object in a patient after surgery or other procedure. So I think all of the same caveats about, well, they say surgery or procedure anyway in this one, but the same caveats from before would apply here in terms of defining the surgical environment or the procedural environment. Is this SRE relevant to the care environment that we're talking about?
Yes.
I think yes, especially I know OB has a lot of issues with retained sponges and other things in outpatient procedures. Okay, so is it discrete, auditable, and clearly defined?
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Does it meet the criteria of serious, unambiguous, and preventable or largely preventable?
I think so, yes.
Yep.
Okay, and so then in terms of the modifications, modification one, it was to change the term to medical or surgical item rather than foreign object, to sort of broaden the, you know, what we're defining as not wanting to be left inside.
That seems reasonable to me.
I agree, it's more specific.
I think so, too. And I know there's a lot of issues with, you know, little tips of wires and screws and this and that. And I think medical or surgical item is a little more clear.
Mm-hmm. Is it excluding anything, I think, is what we would want to think about. Is it narrowing rather than clarifying?
Right.
There's something that would be considered not a medical or surgical equipment that might be left that then would be excluded by this.
Well, I suppose if you look at the bullet, one example below, a bullet is not a medical or surgical item, but would probably, unless intentionally, you wouldn't want to necessarily leave it in. So it's an interesting question. Are we narrowing too much and sort of leaving out?
I think from my perspective, the issue is we don't want to be in the, let's see. If a procedure is done to extract an object and the procedure isn't successful, and so some foreign object is left behind, that's maybe an issue with the performance of the procedure, but it's more of an issue with how it got there in the first place. And I think that is different than what's intended by this SRE. I think that the issue is more how do we make sure that our medical procedurists aren't doing harm.
Right.
Rather than failing to achieve an optimal outcome.
I think that's a good clarification. The only thing with the failing to achieve an optimal outcome is if they, you know, don't make a conscious decision to leave something, but inadvertently don't, let's say there are two fragments of something that they want to remove, and they take one and don't look for the second.
Yeah, point well taken.
I do think the intent of this one is really on the medical or surgical item, though, so... I might prefer the medical or surgical item over foreign object. Or we could suggest we say foreign object such as, and just have clarification, you know, such as, you know, medical or surgical items, et cetera, and sort of just have a clarification of what we mean by foreign object.
Foreign object or foreign body is a medically acceptable term. In my organization, we talk about retained foreign bodies, meaning very many things, and people don't. We haven't even discussed changing that to retained medical or surgical equipment. So it takes us down to: does this even need clarification in a medical environment, or is that term foreign object or foreign body understood medically?
So maybe it would be good just to have the clarification of what that is in the implementation guidance, et cetera, but not necessarily change the language, since I agree people are pretty familiar with this terminology. What do folks think about that?
I think that's fine.
Okay. Suggestion two was consider retained fragments of equipment to fall under device events. So this was more of a shifting from one SRE to another. That might be more of a steering committee discussion, really, than for us to have to worry about. But it was the reason we did propose this was because it, you know, if a device has a little fragment fall off, we thought it was more of a device event that the FDA should know about, et cetera. So putting it under device event might raise it up to a higher level in some ways by having it called a device event. Thoughts on the matter? Should we just move on? No thoughts. We'll move on. Okay, number three, modified to unintentional retention. So that is an interesting one. I mean, there are times when orthopedists, for instance, will decide to leave something in intentionally. The word unintentional could be a good clarification.
I actually support that, and we've had lots of discussions with the Quality and Patient Safety Group here, generally speaking in an operative environment, but sometimes there will be circumstances where you make a conscious decision to leave something in because of the, you know, risk of removing it, the lack of harm, whatever it may be. So I think that is a good clarification that I would support.
I agree. I support that as well.
Anyone not agree with that? Okay. Number four, we've already talked about, and number five, recommends specifically including vaginal births as an invasive procedure. So that would be, I guess, in the implementation guidance, just a clarification about that. Not sure that's totally relevant in our office practice. Well, could happen, but...
Seems out of scope.
Seems out of scope for RTAP.
Yep.
The only thing, as I was reviewing this before the end, this is getting really weird and extreme. The only thing I thought of this would be nurse midwives who are doing home births or that kind of thing. Does that any way relate? But again, I don't think it matters so much to us. It's probably out of scope.
I think it's out of scope for our particular TAP. So, okay, are there any other modifications to this one that folks can think of?
Nope.
Okay, and is this one entirely preventable or largely preventable?
Entirely.
Clarifications, it should be entirely preventable so that, you know, an intentional retention of a foreign object would not be considered an SRE, then I think it should be entirely preventable.
Okay, so we will go with entirely preventable on this one. Okay, let's move on to letter E. Patient death or serious disability. Hold on. I'm having scrolling issues. Okay. Letter E, intraoperative or immediately postoperative death in an ASA class 1 patient.
I think we, I don't know.
So this is, you know, first we have to talk about, is this relevant to our environment? You know, there's probably a lot of, well, there could be IVCS types of procedures happening in the office setting for sure.
What kind of procedures?
Intravenous conscious sedation.
Right.
IVCS is our acronym, but in, you know, even like, you know, for dental procedures or other kinds of procedures, there are people using conscious sedation. So I guess one question is, would we want to expand, this is immediately post-operative death, intra-op or post-op death, and do we want to say, you know, intra-procedure or post-procedure death, basically, and change the language there to make it more relevant to the TAP, to our TAP environment?
Yes, and I think we should. I mean, I think if we're looking at procedures done in an ambulatory environment, any death associated with that procedure should clearly be considered a serious reportable event.
Exactly. So I think we need to change the language there, but it definitely would be relevant to our environment because, you know, we want to know about the deaths that might be happening.
And I wonder if ASA class 1 is really kind of a euphemism for saying low risk.
Well, which one would think any ambulatory procedure happening should be
low risk.
No risk.
We might actually get rid of the in an ASA class 1 altogether.
Yeah. And but I don't know, you know, I don't know that you, there could be patients who would you know, if they saw an anesthesiologist for a procedure, be defined not as ASA class 1, but still be appropriate to have ambulatory procedures.
Agreed.
You can have a patient, again, using dermatology as an example, you can have a patient with multiple medical problems and comorbidities, but who's perfectly able to have a lesion removed in their primary care, you know, primary dermatologist's office, or have an injection of a joint by a rheumatologist or orthopedist, you know, those kinds of things. So
I think getting rid of the ASA class would be good, because basically in the ambulatory setting, if there's a death around a procedure, one would want to call that an SRE, I think.
Absolutely.
Where sedation is used, or just in general?
I would say in general.
Yeah, I mean, it may not be completely preventable, because you may have unrelated deaths unrelated to the procedure and not the physician's fault, but it would be worth